This episode of Off Camera is brought to you in part by the new QuickBooks Self-Employed. If you work for yourself, QuickBooks Self-Employed helps separate your business and personal expenses so you can quickly track what you spend for work and what you spend on yourself. So try QuickBooks Self-Employed and save up to 50% at tryselfemployed.com/offcamera. You'll be glad you did. Hello and welcome to another edition of Off Camera. I'm your host, Sam Jones, and in this episode, I sit down with actress Jennifer Beals. How does a 17-year-old with one credit as an extra end up in the audition room for the lead in one of the most seminal movies of its decade? And perhaps more importantly, how does an introspective, not highly social student deal with the surreal experience of having her privacy go away overnight? For Jennifer Beals, feeling like an equal opportunity outsider due to her mixed race and the 1-2 punch of losing her dad and discovering her family was shockingly poor at age 9 may have provided the best, if uninvited, coping mechanisms. As humble as she is beautiful, the actress who says she'd never make it on So You Think You Can Dance shares the blow-by-blow experience of her Flashdance audition, which was the breakthrough role she came very close to turning down. She also talks about dealing with the boys' club that was Hollywood filmmaking in the 80s and then returning to school at Yale immediately afterward. Given that she's continued to take on roles portraying strong, independent women and often using them to integrate acting with activism, it's surprising to learn she's often happiest retreating to the rich, solitary realm of her imagination. But when she tastes a role she wants, watch out. She's ready to come out swinging. Talking to Jennifer Beals is inspiring in so many ways, but perhaps most so because after decades of work in what can be a very challenging business, and tough for women in particular, she still feels joy at the thrill of jumping in. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, Sam.
Thanks for coming and doing this.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Are you kidding me?
I really appreciate it. You and I have known each other for a while, and this is an opportunity for me to sort of get to know a side of you that maybe I never would have as a friend, because I get to delve into your entire career. And I really enjoyed this week, you know, digging into all your projects, and a lot of which I knew and some of which I didn't. But the other thing I did was I read a lot of interviews. And in a couple of the interviews, you claim that as a kid you were shy. And knowing you now as an adult, that just blows my mind.
Well, it's funny, because when I say shy, it doesn't mean to me that I couldn't advocate for myself. Like, I could advocate for myself, but I never felt part of sort of the in crowd, or I never felt like on the inside of the circle. And I still don't feel like I have to go out to parties or go and socialize. Like, maybe it's less shy and just not particularly social, I guess. I don't know.
Like, was there a realization where you said, oh yeah, I don't fit in there, or?
Well, I think racially, I started thinking maybe a little bit racially when I was really young, because we lived in an all-black neighborhood, and I thought I fit in with everybody until we found this stray dog in the alley, because the alley was sort of the center of the universe. Like, there were the Alley Olympics, you know, you played tennis against the wall, you did all kinds of shenanigans in the alley.
And this was in Chicago.
In Chicago, on the south side of Chicago. And we found this stray dog, and we fed it, and we were really, you know, nurturing of this dog. And I remember this boy in the neighborhood saying, oh, the dog likes Whitey. The dog likes Whitey. And I was like, who is he talking about? And I thought, oh, wow. I think then I probably realized that that's how that boy saw me.
And how did you see yourself?
God, as a kid who, you know, just as a girl, I guess. Like, I didn't think about it so much, especially at that age. And then on the other hand, like, I remember my brother played soccer against this team in Chicago that's predominantly white school, Irish Catholic school. And apparently he was scoring too much on them. And this kid from the other school called him a nigger and punched him from behind. And then subsequently, we started getting calls at the house, and like some guy calling me a nigger bitch. And it's like, well, wait a minute. No, I'm like whitey to this guy, but I'm the nigger to this guy. And then when I did Flashdance, the Puerto Rican community claimed me. And I was like, I'm not Puerto Rican. I may look Puerto Rican, but I'm not Puerto Rican. So yeah, I guess I probably when I was young, I started realizing, well, according to them, I'm not part of this group, and according to this group, I'm not part of that group, and I'm not part of this group, I'm not part of the, well, gosh, I might as well just be myself, because you are not going to be able to please everybody. I think that's probably a really early lesson of you're not going to be able to please everybody. And in a funny way, I think when people who are living in a conventional structure or conventional ethos point the finger at you, calling you different and trying to demean you for your difference, I think it's mostly because they probably feel like you're somehow threatening to them or you're criticizing them. And at a certain point, you realize that's their issue, and you just have to live your life. And as my friend says, say yes to the call. Say yes to the call and to your own path.
So did you feel, even when you were young, did you feel a strength from that, like that realization? Or did that take a while to sink in that being different can actually, you can draw strength from that?
I think it happened pretty quickly because I read a lot, and I read a lot of mythology, and I read a lot about beings that were two things simultaneously, and those mythical creatures had particular powers, and so I felt in some ways like fortunate to be different. I mean, certainly sometimes as a kid, like you're in fourth, fifth grade, you know, it's painful because you want to fit in somehow. But at the end of the day, like I wasn't gonna fit in.
I have a almost 9-year-old daughter, and another thing that struck me is that you lost your father when you were 9 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered if that, you know, how things changed in your family when that happened, or if that was a big change in your personality.
Well, I realized we were poor then. I was like, oh, we don't have any money. Wow, that's interesting. Literally after my dad died, my mom found out that we had $400 in the bank.
Really?
She had $400 in the bank. That was it. She had three kids. And we were all going to private school. And I don't know what kind of smoke and mirrors my dad could perform, but there was a lot of smoke and mirrors going on because we would travel. He loved to travel, and he loved meeting new people and seeing new places and experiencing different cultures and exposing that to us. Like, we went to Greece, we went to Europe, we went to all these different places, and I'm thinking to myself, how did he do it? Like, to this day, I don't know how he did it. My mom said to me something, it was something about the milk coupons. Like he had figured out something with like the milk coupons that people would bring in, so he would lower the price of his milk at the store because he owned a grocery store.
Okay.
And so there was some kind of shell game with the milk coupons, I think.
He
owned a couple of different stores.
Of the milk coupons.
Yeah. No, it wasn't. He wasn't hurting anybody, I don't think. He was just providing us with the ability to travel. But he owned a couple of stores. I think he liked, he was an entrepreneur, you know.
Yeah. So your mom finds out that you have $400.
Yes. Getting back to the story. When my mom finds out that we have $400, and what does she do is she takes all of us, me and my two brothers, on a road trip to Colorado because she wants to go be in the mountains. And so we all get in the car and we're all miserable, as you can imagine. Like, everybody's processing this in their own way, and it's usually not, well, it's not an easy thing to do when you're all shoved in the back seat together. I mean, a road trip isn't easy under the best of circumstances. And my mom and I would sleep in the car, and my brothers would sleep in a tent outside of the car.
Oh, wow.
We had a Pinto station wagon. And then we got to the top of this mountain in the Rockies in Colorado, and we were fighting, and my mom was like, just look around at how beautiful things are. I told you I was gonna cry during this interview. Like, you're like the Barbara Walters of, you know, black and white photography.
That's never been said before.
But then she got out of the car and she was really upset, but trying to hold it together. And I remember her sitting on this rock, and I got out of the car and I sat with her, and I all of a sudden just kind of got it, you know?
Really?
Well, that you're gonna have to make a shift. You make a shift. But, and the love stays with you, but that the world is beautiful.
Wow. I mean, that's a very adult thing to realize at age 9, like, oh, we're poor, and we have to do this all in a different way. And I think you got a job pretty early, too.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. I got a job. I lied and said I was, whatever, 16, 18. I wanted to be helpful to my mom, and I wanted to be able to provide myself with the things that she couldn't provide me with because of our circumstances. So I worked at Bressler's, I worked at Baskin-Robbins, I walked dogs, I babysat, I did all kinds of things. And then my friend, Paige Hanna, and her sister, Daryl Hanna, were going up for commercials and modeling and stuff. And I remember coming with Paige while she was going to a audition for some McDonald's commercial or something. I thought, well, gosh, this is a kind of cool way to make a living. This is interesting. And so I endeavored to get an agent and stuff. And I also worked on a movie called My Bodyguard as an extra and met Tony Bill. And he really helped change the course of my life, for sure.
It's funny, a lot of actors that I talk to, they have this sort of childhood dream of acting or performing, and it doesn't have anything to do with a career or responsibility or anything, but I think that's interesting that you sort of were exposed to it from, like, well, this would be easier than scooping ice cream or walking dogs.
And it was also, I think it also coincided, when looking back, it coincided before even my dad died. I was really interested in what the mystery was. Like, what is this mystery? Like, I got wind that there was something else going on, something beyond what I could see with my eyes. There's something else going on. And I wanted to know about that something else. And I would spend a lot of time by myself. I mostly spent my childhood really, you know, alone in my room, coming up with games and stuff. And I remember some poor girl from the neighborhood wanted to come over and play, and I was like, Mom, don't, I don't want to play with anybody, I want to be by myself. But I just really liked to be by myself, and I would go across the street to the nun's lawn. There was this Catholic school across the street, and they had this huge, beautiful lawn, and I would lay on the lawn, I'd take my little turtle out there, and like I'd play the recorder to my turtle, and I kept finding four-leaf clovers.
Well, you had a pet turtle.
I had a pet turtle. A recorder, and I would play.
We missed an opportunity to photo shoot. I'll tell you that much.
But I think, like, when I look back at it, I think acting is part of that, trying to enter into the mystery or trying to find that mystery, that thing that's not available to us just on the surface, you know?
That alchemy that sometimes comes on a set or during a performance where you're not yourself for a minute, or you feel connected in a certain way.
Yes. And that you are part of something that is so much greater than you.
Here comes, ladies and gentlemen,
a word from our sponsor.
Hey folks, let's talk about accounting for a minute. I know it's not the most exciting subject, but if your books are a mess, you'll never be financially successful. So I want to talk to you about the new QuickBooks Self-Employed. It helps separate your business and personal expenses so you can quickly track what you spent for work and what you spent on yourself. Now, for any of you that are self-employed like me and do many things, this feature is essential. For instance, those groceries you bought for your next catering gig won't get mixed up with the food you bought for the cookout with your friends this weekend. QuickBooks Self-Employed also helps take the guesswork out of your estimated quarterly and year-end taxes. So come tax time, you know how much money to set aside for Uncle Sam and how much stays in your pocket. QuickBooks provides you the tools to help you maximize deductions like home office and mileage, so you keep more of your hard-earned money. Find out what QuickBooks Self-Employed can do for you and save up to 50% at tryselfemployed.com/offcamera. That's tryselfemployed.com/offcamera. And now let's get back to the show.
A lot of people resent the idea of any claim of overnight success. Like, you know, I remember talking to Matt Damon on this show about Good Will Hunting and how he found it so funny that people called him an overnight success because he'd had his SAG card for 10 years at that point, you know.
Right.
But you were in one film as an extra.
Right.
And then you get Flashdance. How did you end up in the room auditioning for a lead in a film when you've done one movie as an extra?
Right. Isn't that funny?
Yeah,
it's really funny.
It just doesn't happen.
I don't know if it would happen today. So I'm 18, and I know that I'm gonna go to college, and
you've been accepted to Yale.
I've been accepted to Yale.
Which is no small feat.
You know, was so elated because it's where I really, really wanted to go.
You weren't on the actor path at all. You were...
I wasn't thinking, I'm going to be an actor. I thought, I'm going to study American literature because I love American literature and that makes me feel alive. And I knew that they had a really great drama program and I knew that I would probably partake of the drama program. But the first thing that was on my mind was Walt Whitman. Like, that was on my mind.
Right.
And I'm thinking, how am I going to make that money while I'm at school? I don't know how I'm going to be able to do it because I'm going to be working at school. And I started working as a model, which is hilarious because I'm just not a model at all. And I got a couple of jobs primarily based on the fact that I looked slightly similar, like the top model of that time in Paris. So I would get this I would get jobs based on the fact that I kind of look like this woman. So anyway, I get a physical letter, not an email. I get a physical letter saying that there's this movie that's kind of like Saturday Night Fever, and they want to see me, and can I come back through New York? And I didn't write her back, and it was taking me a while. So then she phoned the neighbor, and the neighbor came over and said, you know, this person's calling you. So I said, okay, I'll come back through New York. I fly into New York, and I stay. I haven't budgeted really to be staying in New York. Like, that wasn't in the budget. The next day, I go in to the casting call, and they say, "Oh, we can't see you," which is when I was scheduled to go. And they said, "We can't see you today. We need to push it back 2 days." I'm thinking, I don't know where I'm gonna stay, and I then stay at the 63rd Street Y.
Really?
And then I kind of run out of money. And I found this park, I want to say it's in the 70s. It's like a little park. It's not like I'm sleeping in Central Park, but it's a little park. And I sleep on the bench.
And
I'm eating blueberries and pine nuts because I'm 18 and not very bright, I guess. And I go into the audition, and all they say, "Oh, can you come back tomorrow?" And I'm like, "Oh my God, I can't sleep in the park again." And so I call my mom, and which I should have done from the get-go, but I was so used to being self-sufficient that it was seemed odd to call my mom. Anyway, she said, "Oh, your step-grandfather lives in New York." And I said, "Oh, okay." And she said, "Here's his number, and I'm sure he'd be happy to see you." And so I called him, and he's so lovely, and he lives in a lovely apartment with a spare bedroom, which I could have been sleeping in the whole time.
Oh my God.
So I sleep there, and he feeds me bagels and lox and everything the morning of the audition. And so I had a little protein in me. It was good. And I went to the audition, and Adrian was there. Mm-hmm. Adrian Lyne was there. And basically, he asked me to dance. He put on this music, and he asked me to dance. And then he had me do this scene, and I cried during the scene, probably because I was so deprived of true nutrition. And then I was eager to get back home. And so I flew back to Chicago, and then I get a call saying they want to do a screen test.
Okay.
And my agent's very, very excited. And I said, well, you know, I haven't read the script. So how do I know if I want to do it or if I should do it? And so she gets me the script and I read it and I say, well, it has nudity in it. I don't want to do any nudity. So no, thank you. So you can imagine on the other end of the phone, like her head's ready to explode, you know, probably.
And she knows the size of this deal, right? And she knows what a one in a million shot it is that you've already been called.
She,
and you're like, ah,
well,
forget it.
Well, no, I don't think this is going to work for me. So then I get a call. I'll never, ever forget, like, being in our little teeny tiny kitchen and Adrian calling me at home, telling me that he's going to take care of me and that and I'll look beautiful and all these things. And I'm thinking, I don't know you. Like, I just don't know you. So that's really nice of you to say, but I don't know you. And so they gave me the option of a body double, which I didn't understand, I think, probably at that age, what that really meant. So I was like, okay. And he seemed like he really wanted me to come. So I went and I did the audition and the screen test in Los Angeles, and there were so many women there.
And all being screen tested?
All being screen tested.
Okay.
You're in the trailer, you're with these other women who have just done a scene that you're about to do, and you're all talking, and you're all talking about what happened, and you're all talking about the guy who they were reading with, who was Kevin Costner. And they were, you know, and everybody's giggling and, you know, talking to each other about what's happening. And then it was my turn to go and do these scenes, and it's a studio and it's a camera and everything's lit. The crew is there, so it's a full-on screen test. It's like, you know, you're doing the scene, and you have props and you have wardrobe, and you have hair and makeup, and luckily I had Adrian there to help me, and it was really. Like, I really enjoyed it. Like, it was really fun. It was
really,
really fun.
Did you walk out thinking, I nailed it, or?
I didn't even think to think in those ways.
Really?
I didn't think to think in those ways. I just thought, oh, okay, I did that, and that was really interesting. And then went back home and got in my car and drove from Chicago to New Haven by myself in the car, all packed up. And was there at school for a couple weeks, I guess, maybe. And I didn't have a phone. And I called in to my agent, and she was like, I've been trying to get a hold of you. You got the movie, you got the movie. And I was like, okay. Well, I'm gonna have to take the weekend to think about what this means. And I have to talk to my dean, and I'll call you on Monday. What? And so I did. I sat down with my dean and I said, you know, this thing has happened. And he said, well, actually, a lot of people take time off to work on various projects, so that's completely possible.
Wow. Obviously, we all know what happens next, and it becomes this crazy runaway hit. And, you know, in reading about Flashdance, it's Don Simpson and Jerry Bruckheimer's first, you know,
right,
producing collaboration together. And I have to picture, you know, this is early 80s, and this is like the height of like boys club filmmaking. And I wondered who really you could turn to and who you felt like when your whole world's turning upside down, who was in your corner that didn't have another agenda.
I was getting a lot of pressure to do nudity. You know,
and you were after there was a body double, and then
there was like a little pressure, you know, to do it. I got invited to go to this Gary Hart fundraiser.
Oh yeah.
And so I went to this.
He did nudity, I think.
Don't even.
Anyway.
So I go to this party, and when I was in high school, I was a huge fan of Reds, the Warren Beatty movie Reds. I loved Reds. I thought that was such a great movie. And so at the party, Jack Nicholson is there, and Warren Beatty is there. And you know, I think Jack Nicholson is just the coolest thing ever, and I'm sort of following him around the party, and I'm not saying anything, I'm just like a good 10 feet, but just trying to, you know, listen in. He turns to me and he's like, my name is Jack, you know, what's your name? And I introduce myself, and he was really cool, and then he said, you know, I want you to meet my friend Warren, and he comes over, and he brings me over to Warren, and I'm like, you know, I loved your movie Reds, you're, you know, such a wonderful filmmaker, blah, blah, blah. And he said, are you that girl that's working on the new film at Paramount? And I said, yeah. And he said, if you have any trouble, he said, call me. And he gave me his number.
Really?
And he said, you know what? He said, let's have lunch next week if you can. And I said, okay. And so I had lunch with him, and he was kind of like my godfather. It was really interesting.
Like, no kidding.
And whenever, there was only one time on the set where I pulled out the number, and nobody ever bothered me again.
Really?
And I don't know if he ever called, if it was just coincidental, that I have no idea. But in my mind, like, he was my godfather at that.
So the pressure to do nudity sort of stopped.
Nobody asked me again.
No kidding.
And I don't know if that was him or if that was just a coincidence. It could have been. I have no idea.
Wow, you're kind of like Zelig. You just sort of wander into the Hannah auditions, and then you're off at a party, and there's...
Yeah, say yes to the call.
Say yes to the call.
To the call, you know, find the way. It was interesting. It was certainly an interesting time. And I just, you know, I wondered why everybody was behaving so strangely. Like, it was such a strange time. People were acting so strange. And then later on, somebody said, well, most of the people were on cocaine. I was like, oh, that's what it was. Because I couldn't get it. I didn't get it. Like, the mood shifts of some people, I didn't understand it.
And that film comes out, and everybody knew about it. It was huge. And you became this icon immediately. And I just, you know, looking at it now and looking back at that time, I realize you didn't get to ease into being famous. You didn't get on a show where, you know, oh, that you were sort of the supporting actor here and then this, and then you went from nobody knows me to everybody knows me, right?
Yeah.
Like, overnight.
Yeah.
And,
right.
Okay. And I'm sure that is something you just can't prepare for, but I guess I wondered if it, like, came with some sort of resentment that, like, without even sort of being prepared for that, your private life just goes away.
I don't think I ever felt, I didn't feel resentful. I distinctly remember being at the premiere of Flashdance. It was the first time I had seen the movie, and I was with my brothers, and I was watching the movie with everyone, and I saw myself, and I heard all these people responding to that image, and all of a sudden, it seemed like that image was more real than me, because all these people knew this person, but they didn't know me. And I had this very existential, odd moment, and where I subsequently went into the ladies' room and stayed there for most of the rest of the night until my brothers came in and just started making me laugh and kind of brought me back into my body, I guess. And yeah, I mean, for somebody who wasn't particularly social, who likes to spend a lot of time by themselves or watching people, or it was odd, you know, it was an odd time.
And then, did you, over the subsequent weeks of the film being out, did that experience of just sort of being recognized and people approaching you, did that require a shift?
Well, I think because I was at school, I was at university, that allowed me to ease into it because, you know, people didn't come up to me at school because Jodie Foster was already there. So they, I think, were already accustomed to, you know, an actor who has some notoriety being at school. And so nobody really came up to me. So I kind of had the opposite problem where nobody would come up to me. So it was, I had to really get out of this shell in order to make friends.
Oh, right. Like, right? It's the elephant in the room.
Well, kind of, but not even, there's no even elephant. Like, nobody's, it doesn't, it's not even filled with that tension that I can see. It's just nobody is talking to me.
Right.
I'm surprised you don't have tissues here, frankly.
Listen, like we're going to have to get that. We don't have a budget for tissues.
Okay.
That's the problem.
Right, bring your own.
Yeah.
B-Y-O-T.
B-Y-O-T.
That's
right.
Yeah.
Knowing you and knowing, you know, how it isn't your personality to seek the spotlight, it must have been, I mean, it must have been weird. And it also must have been weird just to be that young and have to deal with a public image. But I also think, and what I respect tremendously about you at that young age was the amount of poise and the amount of just wherewithal you had so young to say, no, I'm going back to school and I'm gonna finish what I started and I'm not going to let this fame steer me off on a course that I don't want to go.
My agent Martha, who was Martha Luttrell at the time, was so supportive of my decision to go back to school. You know, she was so supportive. She's like, it's a long road, you know. You do what you need to do right now because it's a long road.
Right.
Like, it's not a sprint. It's not a sprint. Like, as I think about it now, you know, it's a long, long course. It's a long course. It's a long distance event.
Yeah.
So go back and do what you need to do. I remember one time I was with Alan Rudolph at the Cannes Film Festival and somebody asked him about his career and he said, I haven't had so much of a career as a careen. And it's, and I get it, like I get that feeling. I got the sense at that time, I mean, my career would have been completely different. And I think if I had been the type of person that was going, this is the thing that I want and I'm gonna go get this thing. Like if that had been the thing that I wanted, I think my career would be very, very different. But what I wanted was still this mystery inside the story and the way that I knew how to experience that was through reading and thinking and connecting to other people who were reading and thinking about the same piece of material.
Right.
And Hollywood at that time seemed a little like it could get me off my course. Maybe it was all the people on cocaine. I don't know.
I wasn't going to say it.
I don't think I would have ever been a drug person, but I think that it could be the wrong focus of, you know, wanting to be famous. Like that wasn't ever my goal, to be famous. Like you talk to so many kids now, and you ask them what they want to be when they grow up, and so many of them will say famous.
Right.
And it breaks my heart. It breaks my heart. Like I don't even know what to do with that. I don't even know what to do with it. It's like there is something so much bigger and so much brighter inside of you than that, because that can come and go. But there's this eternal thing inside you that is the real brass ring.
Yeah.
You know?
You have had this amazingly long career, and a lot of people in your profession don't get to have that long of a career and don't get to still be excited about projects. As I look over what you've done in your career, I look at what you bring to these characters that you decide to play, and not only the choices of the roles that you choose to take on, but also the backstories you infuse them with or the attempt to address, say, a larger issue.
What's interesting, and I think what we're starting to get at a little bit, which interests me greatly, is how one role starts to affect the next role, can affect the next role, and how, in this case, I think what I'm most conscious of is that it starts with Bette Porter from The L Word, who was this fairly strong woman and definitely an outsider in every kind of which way. And having the honor of playing her for 6-7 years then informs, then when I get cast as the superintendent of the Chicago Police Department, taking that strength with me, that thing that I've learned about myself through this other person, because I feel like they're all real, like, and I'm kind of escorting them into this other, I'm escorting them into being seen by people, like I'm trying to help them come into the world in a way, and it's like we're together, and sometimes it feels like when I'm starting a project, there's a castle and it's all closed and I can't figure out how to get in, and I'm with the other person and the character, and we're walking around trying to find the door in. And once you're in, you can start on this other journey. But in this case, Bette informs Teresa Colvin, which then informs the character that I played in a piece called Lauren on Wigs. I start to cultivate my own strength so that I can play them, and by playing them, they're helping me cultivate my strength. You know, their strength is informing mine, and mine is informing them, and it's like this interesting dance in a way. But I think starting to get cast as independent, strong-willed women starts from that process. Maybe it comes from me somewhere, I don't know, but then it starts from people seeing you as that other part.
Right.
And when I think about becoming involved with activism, I would have never become an activist, I don't think, if I hadn't have done The L Word. But by virtue of being on The L Word and meeting so many amazing LGBT activists and seeing how passionate they were and how dedicated they were and understanding how they were organizing and watching them organize and watching them fundraise and watching them message and trying to figure out how to get the message across was so interesting to me. It was such an education, so that then when I'm playing Teresa Colvin in Chicago Code and I'm having to deal with aldermen, and again I'm having to deal with politics and how people message, I can take all of that in my own life, and then all of a sudden it occurs to me that there are some really dire environmental health issues going on, particularly in regards to children. And 20 years ago, I wouldn't have known what to do with that. Like, I would have felt completely overwhelmed. But because I now have this knowledge base from this character, this character, this character, and these sets of communities that that these characters are a part of, whether it's the Chicago Police Department, or it's the military, or it's the LGBT community, it's like, oh, like, you know, I've got my people behind me who are helping me and telling me sort of in my ear or in my imagination, okay, this is what you need to do. And you have the strength to do it. And if not you, then who?
Well, you know? That's, you know, you mentioned Lauren. I think you're talking about being sort of a conduit too as well for someone like me who I see Lauren, your web series, that, you know, sort of crosses the line between acting and activism in the way that at the end of each episode, there's statistics up on the screen of how much abuse occurs in the military. And and it puts this other layer of understanding onto the characters. So it's actually working on an entertainment level. But you find yourself in the center of these stories a lot. And just like with The L Word, I think that, you know, you take this character and you make her this kind of dominant in the relationship woman that, that empowers people in a way, you know?
Bette Porter, I love her.
Well, you know, a good friend of mine is Michelle Abbott, who was one of the original creators on The L Word. And so I called her before doing this interview with you. And I said, you know, what were your initial recollections of Jennifer and the way the show started and how it got on the air? And she said, We never would have gone on the air if we didn't get Jennifer, because she was, I don't think she knew it, but she was this icon in the LGBT community.
No, I had no idea.
And I said, well, why? And she goes, it was because she was a welder by day, and she was
could
like
have been a softball
tough
player.
But it's funny how you were sort of already an icon, and yet at the same time as the L word is going on, you are having a baby and having this very traditional family experience.
But I didn't really focus on her being gay. Like, I didn't really focus on that so much until my husband and I were at a restaurant, and he leaned over and kissed me, and I realized at that moment that if we were a gay couple, that kiss would have been a really big deal in that particular restaurant. And then all of a sudden I had this kind of shift in my mind about what it was that I was doing. I said, if one girl somewhere who doesn't have access to her community, who doesn't see herself reflected in the mainstream media, if one girl feels connected and feels like she's got a community somewhere and that her life is valid and she is worthwhile, and not only worthwhile, but maybe a little fierce even too, like maybe she's pretty fabulous, then I will be really, really happy, like just for that one person. Your emotional life is the center of a story. Your character's emotional life is the center of a story. Was really, really interesting and really gratifying on so many levels.
You know, you mentioned also your outsider feeling informing that character. You're sort of still an icon in the LGBT community. Like, you're one of them.
I do feel like an honorary gay lady.
Yeah.
I've learned so much from that community, and it's such a, you know, fierce, like intense, passionate, dedicated group of people that I met who were determined not to remain invisible.
Right.
You know, and that was really, really exciting to be around.
Here it comes, ladies and gentlemen.
A word from our sponsor.
Hey, folks, when was the last time you thought seriously about your underwear? The other day, here at the off-camera headquarters, I received a box full of MeUndies underwear, and I tried them on, and I've been wearing them ever since. And that's the truth. I put on these MeUndies, and they're just great underwear. They're soft, they're comfortable, they don't ride up, they're just perfect underwear. And the truth is, we are in our underwear almost 90% of our life, so it should be comfortable. So once I started wearing this underwear around, I started wondering how it's different and why it feels so good. And this is what I found out. The materials they use are sustainably sourced from the Austrian Alps, and they are completely natural. They also use a CO2 neutral process with a low carbon footprint. So my underwear is green, even though they're not, they're gray, but they're green. They save water and energy due to their spun-dyed fiber process. And MeUndies isn't just for guys. They just launched their All of Me women's collection, a four-piece line of undies designed specifically for the female body. Check out the photos for yourself at MeUndies.com and try them. I think you're going to find that, like me, you're never going back to any other kind of underwear again. Now, this quality would typically retail for 2 times the MeUndies price. But since you get them directly from the company online, there's no retail middleman, and that means more savings for you. Go to MeUndies.com/camera and get 20% off your first order and free shipping. Save even more when you buy a pack of them. And here's the best part. They guarantee you're going to be happy with them or your first pair is free. Once you feel MeUndies on your body, you're never going back. Now let's get back to my conversation with Jennifer Beals.
What do you grab onto first when you read a script, or what do you look for that says, this is someone I either want to learn how to do or I can do?
I think it's the first reading, like, and does it, do you feel connected? Do you feel connected even in that first reading kind of way?
Right.
And then building off of that.
Connected to the person or
intuitive,
the whole story?
There are times when my ideal, the fantasy, the toppermost, poppermost, is when I'm not only connected to the character, but I'm connected to the whole story.
Right.
And that feels really good, because that facilitates like wanting to enter into the full mystery, like the whole package. But there are times when I've taken projects because I'm interested in the character, against my better judgment usually.
Uh-huh.
Really. But it's almost like I say to myself, okay, I'm interested in this character. I know this is like a roll of dice. I don't know what's going to happen with this. But I want to treat it like an acting class, like so that I'm going to experiment and see what I can do and how I can fuck it up. You know?
Yeah.
Like, let's see. Let's just go play and see what happens.
You did say once that you have to find a character's weaknesses before you can really make the character authentic. What does that mean?
Where they're vulnerable, like where find their vulnerability. And if they've got this strong bearing, what is it that they're trying to cover up? What's being hidden?
I'm constantly fascinated with when you see a performance that's believable versus a performance that's not. And I know there's a lot of factors, and some of that can be in the edit room, and some of that can be in the story.
Oh, yeah, God bless the editor, a good editor.
Sure, but at the same time, I think that, you know, a lot of that work is unseen.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'm sure the process is unique to every actor, but I did, when I read that thing about finding weaknesses, I wanted to know more about that.
Well, I think it gives you an active thing to play, that if you're covering up something, or there's, what is that thing you don't want to show to people? And what do you do to make sure they don't see it? And when is strength and that warrior bearing genuinely like a ferocity, I guess? And when is it, I'm going to protect myself? Who am I protecting? What
right.
am I protecting? And of myself, meaning the character, and other people. And so that can cause like a, for me anyway, it can be fun to play with that tension.
And I wondered if you feel the need to always tell the director about what you've done in the background.
No. It's nice to have secrets. And a really great director knows that you don't have to share it with them. Because sometimes you say it out loud and you're all of a sudden switched realms and you want to stay in that other realm of pretend. And then you start telling all your secrets, then all of a sudden you're kind of out of the realm of pretend in a funny way.
Right.
And it's not everything, because I talk to directors, ones that I can trust. I talk to them a lot about what I am thinking, and because I also want to hear what they're thinking. I want to hear, you know, I'm all ears for really good advice and good suggestions, and I've been blessed to work with some very, very wonderful directors. But then there are certain things I keep for myself. Like I keep for myself, and it's nice.
You strike me as someone who, you enjoy the prep. You enjoy like...
Oh, I love it. I love it. It's
like,
so much
it's
fun.
It's like school for you, right?
Like it's better than school. Like
yeah.
It's so much fun, because then you're entering into this other person's world.
Often I'm sure you're the most experienced one on set, and you're developing your own projects, and you're more involved in a producer role a lot of the time. I just wonder if there's a piece of wisdom that you gained through kind of, in a sense, crossing over to where, you know, you're not just waiting for your agent to call. You are creating things that you want to work on, creating things that you are interested in. You are putting together a project and a team.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if there was something that sticks out to you about that shift that happened for you.
I wanted to see certain stories, and I didn't necessarily need to be in them, but there were certain stories that I wanted. There's certain things I just want to see, and I get really excited when I think about it. I go, oh, I really want to see that. So can we make that so I can see it and be part of it in some way, as a storyteller or as a facilitator for other storytellers to tell the story in a much more engaging way than I could ever tell the story. I feel for the producers more, and I see certain things. It's funny, I see things on set a little bit differently. And just recently I said to a director, you got to go protect your story. Like, this thing is happening on set right now. You go protect your story. And to me, it's about, protecting the story. Like, the story is a very real thing in a way. And I want that then to come to life in the same way that I've wanted characters to come into the world. Like, I want that story to come in the world, but the story is so much harder to get in the world. It's like, oh my God, it's sometimes like pushing this huge boulder
right
up, and we'll see what happens.
I am fascinated with this whole character building idea. I think because acting to me is such a mystery. Mm-hmm. And the ones who do it well make it look so easy that the rest of us think we can do it. And the minute we all go into our bathrooms and try it in front of the mirror, it seems impossible. So I am fascinated with that idea of building a character and where do you start? And what you said about the castle makes a lot of sense to me, because once you find the door, it's not like you have to keep going through doors. Once you're in, there's a lot of information.
A lot of information, but then it's like more and more and more. There are other doors then that you find and other doors that you find. For me, it's sometimes the door can be a different thing. Sometimes, I usually start with the vulnerability or the text. Anyway, it's you starting with the text, and then, but then there are other times that the wardrobe will really inform things. And when I was working on Book of Eli, I worked really closely with Sharon on the wardrobe, and I made my own jewelry, and I made it from things that I would have found. And that was really exciting. And I remember at one point, my daughter had asked me about the movie, and I couldn't really explain completely everything because she was far too young to take that in. But I said to her, well, she's kind of like a queen that's lost her crown. And she said, well, why has she lost her crown? And I said, you tell me, why did she lose her crown? And she said she had to sell it for food. And I said, that's exactly right. And so in my mind, I was the queen without a crown who had to sell it for food. And it informed so much.
When you tell that story about your daughter, it makes me think of like a key, like some little thing she said gave you the key that unlocked so much more, right?
Yes, yeah.
I mean, is that what we're trying to do whenever we attempt an artistic endeavor? Are we trying to find something that totally makes sense to us, and that it gives it context?
Yes, and I think by making sense to you, then it makes sense to other people.
Right.
And then if you can connect to it, then other people can usually connect to it.
That touches on something that's really, really valid, which is that no matter how much experience you have, if you're trying to create something new, if your work involves creating something new, then that experience can only take you so far, and the process of discovery is half of it, right?
Yeah, and wanting to, and feeling that you are capable of going deeper, and wanting so badly to figure out how to do that, how to do it, and then knowing that if you're focusing on going deeper, then you stop yourself in a funny way. It becomes too self-aware, so that you have to find another way in.
Yeah, because you want to retain that, almost like you said with your daughter, you want to retain the ability to grab something out of thin air and have it feel real, rather than just use craft.
Right, but there's sometimes, for at least in my experience, where I've had to just let's get crafty. Let's get crafty, because I'm not sure how to get through this situation.
Right.
Where either I've had, tricky situations with people that I'm working with, or, things that I'm going through, and you realize, okay, I know a couple things maybe. Like, I know a couple, like, just to help me get through this thing and to be as truthful as I can be in this moment. But there's that other thing that you wish for, like those moments that you wish for that are kind of where you are in your body, but you're not in your body, and it's so much fun. Like, some people like snowboarding or, skateboarding and going on the pipes and doing all these stuff. And to me, that moment of action where you enter into the unknown is so thrilling.
Like, does that ever get old?
No.
That's the great thing about what you do, right? They can call action and you can still feel that rush of...
You're diving in now.
I was reading about your new show that's coming out on TNT called Proof, and which is produced by Kira Sedgwick.
Yes.
And one thing that fascinated me about this story I was reading was she tells the story of you coming into the audition being like the last one of the day. Mm-hmm. And the first thing that fascinates me as I'm reading this is, why are you auditioning? And that's incredible right there. And then she tells this story about, you know, one scene into it, she knows you have the part, you killed it, and she described it like you came in and just took the role. You just came in and took it, and that she was like congratulating you and saying, let's go out for a drink, as, you know, at the audition, which you never do, right? You're never supposed to do that or whatever. But it made me wonder if you still enjoy and relish the challenge of going in to audition and show what you can do.
I think it depends on the project. First of all, Kira is a very kind person. Second of all, as somebody who's starting to produce, I completely respect a director or producer asking somebody to come in and read. Because, yes, there's some people maybe you could take a chance on. I don't know, but you also want to see it. And in my mind, I remember, you know, Meryl Streep having to audition for Out of Africa.
Really?
You know? And I was like, well, if she's going to audition for Out of Africa, like, who am I to say I won't audition? You know, like, I can't imagine it. But it's something that I really love and believe in. And then there are a couple times in my life where I felt like, this is mine. This person is waiting for me. Like, this character is waiting for me. And so I've got to go in and come and go escort my person into the world, and she's waiting for me. So this is what I've got to do, and so I'm going to go do it, and then she and I are going to go into the world.
What's an example of that?
Devil in a Blue Dress was the first real time that it happened, where I had heard of the project through my ex-husband, Alex Rockwell. He and Carl Franklin knew each other. I don't know if they had served on a jury together. I don't remember that part of the story. But he had told Alex that, you know, he was working on this this project that he thought I would be really great for, and wanted to meet with me. And you know, I met with him, and it was great. And then I went to go work on Mrs. Parker and The Vicious Circle, and I didn't hear anything from my agent. I was like, okay, what's going on with Devil in a Blue Dress? And he said, oh, we're checking in. And then I finished the movie, and they said, well, he's decided to go another way because you're too well known, and it's too known that you're of mixed race. And I thought, well, that's silly. And so I called him, and we had this really long conversation, which included fighting and crying and
on the phone.
And he said, well, you know, well, I've been auditioning people, and you know, there's women who've come in who've said, you know, that they've been passing all their life, meaning not saying that they were, you know, part black or whatever. And I said, okay, Carl, like, I've always been really proud to be who I am. And so now I'm going to be punished for having, you know, relished in my background. And we had this, you know, and he said, well, I don't, you know, I want an unknown. And I finally just said, look, have you found your Daphne yet? And he said, no. And I said, that's right, because you're talking to her. And he said, okay, you can come in and audition. And I said, don't do me any favors, you know? Like I'm gonna work really, really hard. And I said, I want you there, and I want Valerie there, who was a casting agent. And he said, okay. And so I literally went into the desert for 4 days and prepared. Literally went to Joshua Tree and prepared. And, you know, went over the scenes, you know, like, till you're, like, hallucinating, because...
Now, do you go with somebody and go back and forth, or just by yourself?
I go by myself to a place, to a cabin, like, where there's no TV or no phone or nothing, and just sort of live in that head for a while. And I drove straight from the desert and, you know, got my hair done. And then went to the audition, and I remember, I think Carl was there, and I said, where is Valerie? And he said, she's on the phone. I said, well, I'll wait for her. I'll wait. And then she came in, and I did the scenes, and we were all crying afterwards and everything. And then I remember getting this call saying that they wanted me to come in and do a screen test. It just was this feeling of, and it doesn't happen very often at all, but it's almost like a taste in my mouth, but it's like coming to claim something. Like, it's like I've got the claim check, so I'm coming to claim it. That's what it sort of feels like.
Really?
Not always, because it doesn't always feel like that. And believe me, I've done some godshite auditions for sure. But generally on things that don't have that connection to. And I did feel a connection to the material of Proof. And I was like, this is mine, you know?
So,
and it's really fun to walk into a room that way, and you don't go around going, this is mine. But it's just a feeling of, I think, connectedness, you know?
When you say Meryl Streep auditioned for Out of Africa, when you say that you went in for Proof and auditioned, and clearly you have a giant body of work that anyone can go and look at, and that you're still so open to that process, I think that's testament that you really love what you do.
It's so much fun.
And I wanted to bring up how, you know, in terms of challenging yourself, you took on a physical challenge recently that is pretty amazing, and that is you did a triathlon.
Yeah, I did a triathlon. After my daughter was born, I did a triathlon. I started getting a little addicted to triathlons. And I did an Olympic distance triathlon. And I was training for a half Ironman and broke my toe 6 weeks before my race. And then tried again the following year. And that year, I mean, I know I went to Yale, but it took me, I don't know, 4 years to figure out that the triathlon is mostly the bike. And I don't really love the bike that much.
Right.
I like the bike, but I don't love the bike. And I was doing this 4K swim race in preparation for the Ironman. And somewhere in the middle of the race, I was swimming in this beautiful lake, and there was this shaft of light coming through the water, and there was this leaf floating in the water, and it just was turned golden, and it was so beautiful. And I'm swimming, and I'm thinking, I love the swim. The swim is my favorite part. So why am I doing this other thing? Why am I making myself suffer if this is what I love? And heretofore, I try not to make myself suffer over something that I don't have to suffer for. Does that make any sense?
Yes.
I try to go towards the thing that I love and that gives me pleasure, rather than going, must do the bike. I was like, no, I don't have to do the bike. I can do long distance swimming.
But that's such a great example of some specific thing, right, that happened in the realm of athletics, that you could apply to your whole life, right?
Like,
yes, that's this
yeah.
realization of yeah, why at some point in life don't do the things that don't make any sense and are hard to do if they're not getting you anywhere. Like,
right.
why put yourself through something you don't have to? Is that...
Yeah, you can get to that other place through joy. And sometimes joy can be the quicker path. You know, so often we're taught that, you know, if you're not suffering, then you're not going forward, or it's not valid, or there will be no growth. And I think that the suffering will come to you anyway. You will suffer. By virtue of being a human being on the planet, you will suffer. There's no getting around it.
So no need to add to it.
You don't need to add to it. It will come to you. And the way you approach it will help you get through it, and will help you get, you know, to your goal or back on another path.
You know, I want to close with something that I read that you said, a story about you being away at camp and getting a letter from your parents.
Oh, yeah.
How the other kids would, when they got a letter from home, would tear into it and read it right away. And you would take this letter and sort of not open it. And
I'd save it for days.
And you wouldn't open it for
no.
a couple days. And,
yeah.
and you know, I got to thinking about that because I was the kid that would have to rip it open right away.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Right.
I was the kid at Christmas that was through all his presents before anyone else had opened one. And it made me think, well, maybe that's a good, that's sort of a good physical analogy for your personality or your fortitude or something, that you want to savor this joy, you want to kind of hold on to it for a while and eke it out. Like, can you tell me, like, what you think the thinking is behind that?
What, saving
that
the letter?
That kid doing that, yeah.
Well, the feeling of getting a letter from people that you love is so sweet. Like, the sweetness of it is just so palpable, and holding this communication is so exciting, and wanting to hold on to that notion of possibility and for as long as I could, or that expectation, or that, gosh, I don't know how to explain it, but it feels like that last page of The Great Gatsby, you know, one day we'll stretch out our arms farther and run faster. That suspension and that holding on to the joy is really, like, I can almost feel the letter in my hand. It's really fun.
Well, it comes through in who you are as a person, and I feel lucky to know you.
So lucky to know you.
Thank you so much for coming and doing
this. Oh, it's my pleasure.
Really,
this was so
it.
Much fun.
Hey folks, you've reached the end of another episode of Off Camera. I hope you're liking the show. And remember, if you want to get the full off-camera experience, go to offcamera.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at @offcamerashow or me at Sam Jones. And if you want to get really personal, send me an email, sam@offcamera.com. And if you're not already subscribed to this podcast, go to iTunes and subscribe. And while you're there, take a minute on iTunes and give us a rating. Anything above 4 stars is acceptable. And make sure to tune in next episode when I sit down with actor, writer, director, and producer Zach Braff.
I guess I was naive, really. I thought it would be cool. I had no idea what was lying underneath this conversation.
Right, right.
So I set about a year of politicking and trying to explain, hey, everybody calm down. I really had good intentions.
Don't miss this fascinating, revealing conversation about the film business. See you next time, off camera.